Good afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. And our sponsor this hour is...
Team Power. Team Power. They're the Kubota tractor dealer in Shasta Lake City in Redding area. They service Shasta, Siskiyou, Tehama, Lassen County. Well, not part of Lassen County. But yeah, all your Kubota needs, go up and see them. They do part sales and service up there. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at RedingTractors.com.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Look at that.
They're the guys.
Hardly any...
Nary a hiccup.
Foolishness, but I've got this stool that's like, I feel like I'm on a perch.
You are. Chirp, chirp.
If I flap my wings and take off, you'll know what happened. It was the perch. Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, by the end of this, we're probably going to be ready to flap our wings and fly off because our topic today is something I guarantee you that I wish we could actually know this, that people who are listening, I wish they could kind of like push a little button and give us like yes or no or thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever. But I'll be nice, and I'll say 95% of the people out there don't know this information, and we all should. The article that our guest has sent is entitled "The Problem with the Current High Potency THC Marijuana from the Perspective of an Addiction Psychiatrist." So we're not talking to somebody who's just a
hater.
There you go. just another hater. That would be us. That's the role we fill in. All we're qualified to do is that.
Yeah.
But she deals with people who are addicted all the time, and that's the one major difference. Most people will tell you that.
And not just marijuana. All
marijuana
addiction.
Is not addictive. Yeah. But we're focusing kind of on that, and I'm sure we'll veer into the other lanes. But our guest today is Dr. Libby Stout. She is a board-certified addiction psychiatrist, worked in the addiction behavioral health field since 1990. So she's kind of been there and done that. She's been the medical director for the CIRCLE program, a 90-day inpatient treatment program funded by the state of Colorado for persons with co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse who failed other levels of treatment. She's been doing that since 1999. And strong advocate of the need to address all addictions at the same time, including tobacco, in order to improve outcomes. I listened to a presentation she did up in Mount Shasta here, like 2nd of February. By the way, the date today, if you're listening, if this happens to go through a replay at some point, we're actually airing this live on February 24th, 2019. Happy birthday to my dad. It's always really nice when something happens where you have to say the date because then you remember whose birthday you were about to maybe skip or forget, which is always bad. And I have a video on there courtesy of Robert Exter, who did the editing on that and has made those available. So the YouTube video, you can view it on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. You click on the show for the 24th of February, 2019. You will see the video there. You can go to YouTube, watch it there, forward the show however you like. We'll have an archive up by 2:15 or so. And then later this afternoon, we'll put the commercial-free archive up, and that will stay there until the website no longer exists. Yeah. And you are free to take those MP3 files, send them to people, copy them. I don't care if you put them on CDs and sell them. We do this program to educate people. So however you want to get the word out is totally good with us.
If you do sell them, I'd like a cut.
Which cut? You want the first hour or the second hour?
Probably first hour.
Oh, you're talking money.
Yeah.
failed that one. So anyway, we'll probably play some silly music just to lessen the pressure. But lest you become confused, we are not fans of marijuana, medical, recreational, or otherwise. And this program will be all about the how not great it is. And this will not be one of those fair and balanced programs because, frankly, I think the how great marijuana is 90% of the conversation out there, which is how we wound up with it legalized in our states. Boo. And the pipe dream of the magical pipeline of money that's going to come. And then if we legalize it, then all the criminals will go away. And
schools will have more money. Everybody will have more money.
I should have played Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I didn't put that in my list for today, but just be humming that in the background. So let's get our guest on here. I know she's on there, Dr. Libby.
It's mostly, hey there, thank you.
Yeah, it's mostly all you now.
Hey, thanks for coming on today. I'm looking forward to this.
I tried to give Bill a synopsis of your talk, and it was like, yeah, it's kind of complicated. We're going to have her on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and you know, I do want to start out by saying I am not a hater.
Oh, we are. Okay. That's all right. We'll be the haters.
When this first happened in Colorado back in 2000, I didn't vote for it. I just thought it was stupid, but I also wasn't that worried about it back then because I had been dealing with people with marijuana addictions for a long time, and I thought at the time it wasn't going to be any different than alcohol, and we would just be treating it the same way. But my perceptions have changed dramatically, and it's mainly because of what has happened with the THC potency. And without any regulation, really, the growers have been able to make product that has huge concentrations of the THC, the psychoactive component of the drug. And this has created considerable havoc, in my opinion, and those are kind of things I want to address.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed that in light of legalization that they haven't put some kind of limitations or at least labeling as far as the potency on marijuana, because it is dramatically different than the old days.
And for people who haven't read the article, by the way, it is posted on the page for today, so we're not going to refer to something you can't ever find. It is on there if you'd like to read the thing. We're not going to read it to you, however, because that would be NPR, I think, mostly. Prior to the 1990s, this is from your article, it says, prior to the 1990s, the THC content was less than 2%. In the 1990s, it grew to 4%, and between 1995 and 2015, there has been a 212% increase in the marijuana flower. So that's the part you smoke and stuff.
That's medical grade now.
But then once you get into the concentrations of the oil and the shatter and the dab and all these edibles and stuff, concentration can be upward of 95%. So in case people think we're talking about some little, you know, micro change, I don't think 2% to 95% is a micro change.
No.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a really good point. And I just think it's really important that we pay attention to history. I mean, people are supposed to learn from history, but
it's the rumor.
I've gone back and looked at the history of cannabis throughout the centuries, and you know, it has been around for centuries, and it has been used medicinally for centuries, but it has been used with that really low potency, what I would call God's product, the natural product that's less than 2%. And if you think about it, any plant is not identical. One plant is different from another plant, and they're all going to vary in their concentration and things. And the cannabinoids differ in terms of the growth cycles, where they are in the growth and between the plants. And so I think what happened, because, you know, it started in China. There were people back in 6000 BC supposedly eating cannabis seeds for food. And then in some time, 4000 BC, they started using it for textiles, that like the hemp plant. And then in the first recorded medicinal use was in 2700 BC. And then it kind of got moved from China and got transported across India and to the Middle East. And I think it's just kind of fascinating that even though it was very, very available, in 1378, the emir of the Ottoman Empire actually made an edict against eating hashish or smoking cannabis.
Oh, really?
And then in 1798, Napoleon had this total prohibition on his soldiers smoking marijuana. And what I've read about that is it's because he recognized that all of the lower class people were utilizing marijuana, and I think that's why he could invade so easily, because they didn't care. And actually, in 1868, Egypt became the first modern country to outlaw cannabis.
Huh.
I just think that's fascinating, and I think it's possible because there were more potent plants in different places, and people were having different reactions, and you know, some people are more susceptible to the effects of THC. But, you know, back then nobody knew anything about that.
Sure.
Right.
Well, and that's one of those things that we're headed into our first break here, but we want to make sure that we go into the effects that we see, because let's face it, the bulk of the public, especially the people who are making the rules, the folks that are, say, 50 and over that are on city councils, and I realize there are younger people, but those folks are significantly out of touch if they're not pot smokers or whatever. They don't know any of this has happened, and they're comparing it to the 2% product of the 1960s and 70s, thinking, well, it's not that big a deal. You know, nobody gets nobody gets addicted. You hear that all the time. So I'm really excited that you're going to finally explain to people as a doctor what you see, and the fact that there is a withdrawal element, and then obviously what this will do to our youth as they start using it and how that's happening. So anyway, we've got a long list of stuff. So we will be right back with Dr. Libby Stout. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Rocky Mountain High, Colorado, Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain fire in the sky. Friends around a campfire, and everybody's high.
And since Dr. Libby Stout is from Colorado, I figured I should just get that one out of the way right away, and then we could be done with it.
Yeah, I love that song.
It used to be a nice song. Now it's kind of annoying, but I was like, all right, I'll put it on the list. We'll do it. Well, we'll do it early.
In the olden days, marijuana used to be classed as a hallucinogen. And hallucinogens are not considered addictive because they don't have a withdrawal syndrome. However, with the higher potency THC, we are now seeing a definite withdrawal syndrome, and we now see it as definitely an addictive drug. And the higher the potency, the more addictive it is. And so that, I mean, this is what all companies do to try and increase their market share. They increase the potency of a drug.
Sure.
If you think about any addictive drug, the higher potency ones are the most addicting ones. So hard liquor is more addicting than beer, 3-2 beer. The marijuana, just the higher the THC content, the more addicting it is.
Well, and if it's not on a hallucinogen anymore, what is it now?
Well, it's kind of in the class by itself, because it does have hallucinogenic properties. That's why people use it.
Right.
It does cause psychotic symptoms. But it also has a significant withdrawal, and so it is addicting.
Well, another thing that I find interesting with marijuana is, you know, they got a foothold in with the medical marijuana. You know, it had all these magical properties. But with any other drug, there's different potencies, like you were saying. You know, when you look at a prescription bottle, it says, you know, so many milligrams of this or so many milligrams of that. I mean, they've got it dialed in to whatever the symptom is. You can treat it with different levels of certain drugs. But with marijuana, it's all the same.
Just throw it at
just
it.
Just throw it. You know, you just go buy marijuana for your medical problem. And the potency, it was never an issue and never a factor in treatment. How'd they get away with that?
Well, again, it's these regulators that don't know anything about it, because I would agree. if you look at the research that has been done on marijuana in terms of what is helpful, all of the research has been done on potencies less than 10%. There isn't anything out there that's a legitimate, well-done study showing that marijuana, THC higher than 10%, is good for anything medical. However, if you go into any dispensary, and it's difficult to tell the difference between what's medical and what's recreational. And the other problem is the part of the plant which is considered to have the most benefit is the cannabidiol, or the CBD. And there's research out there that indicates that perhaps CBD is protective from the bad effects of THC. But right now, it's really hard to find marijuana that is in a one-to-one ratio where you have an equal amount of THC and CBD. Most of the stuff in dispensaries is really the high-potency stuff, where in Colorado, we're looking at plants with, you know, averaging between 17 and 30%. I even heard some people were bragging about how they're getting it up to 40% in the plant.
Wow.
Jeez.
Well, and I think it's interesting, too, that you can go into a dispensary and get marijuana for a medical use, and you're getting medical advice from a pothead behind the counter that's all of a sudden now an expert in illnesses, and he's going to prescribe you a drug to fix what ails you. I mean, how do they get away with that? I mean, that's practicing medicine.
That's an excellent point, and it's good very job, frustrating for those of us who practice medicine, especially in psychiatry, because they've got all these strains that they say are good for depression, good for anxiety, good for bipolar disorder, and people go and then they use those strains. And especially my concern is about somebody with true bipolar disorder who may be on a psychotropic medication for that. I don't hear the bud tenders asking them, well, what medication are you on? Let me tell you if this interacts with your medication. Because it's well known that these products interact with prescription medication negatively. And so nobody's doing that. And then, you know, the study they did in Colorado that was blew me away was calling dispensaries. You know, they had a woman who would call a dispensary and have this script that she would read saying, you know, I'm so many weeks pregnant and I'm having a lot of nausea, and do you have anything you can recommend? And almost 70% of the dispensaries recommended marijuana for the woman. And you can look at the article, they even have quotes, and one bud tender was quoted as saying something like, well, I don't think that you're really supposed to be using it, but if I was going to recommend, I would recommend something in high-potency THC.
Oh, wow. I mean, they don't even want you smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol when you're pregnant, but pot's okay.
Smoke pot. Yeah. Yeah, it's no big deal.
But there's well-known effects of marijuana on the developing brain that are negative.
Yeah.
That's a big part of the problem, and this is what people don't quite understand. Is I think most people don't understand what happens during development, but there's two times when your brain is most active in terms of developing the neurological connections. You know, many animals are born with their brain completely intact. But humans are not. Humans, the brain is continuing to develop over time, and different things come online at different times. And the last thing to really come online is the prefrontal motor cortex, or the seat of judgment, or where you make all your decisions in your brain. And that doesn't really come fully online until late adolescence, early adulthood. And they keep pushing the number out further, but you know, what I heard was 21 in women, 25 in men. And so the brain is continually developing, but the most active times of development are in utero and then during adolescence or during puberty. And the cannabinoid receptors play a very big role in what is happening during development. Now, I just want to point out, I think it's very interesting that we never really knew what the active component of marijuana was until the 1960s. We knew about all the other drugs. We knew why they worked in the brain and why they were addicting. But it wasn't until the 1960s that a lab in Israel discovered THC. And they found that there was a receptor in the brain that THC fit into. And that's why they named it a cannabinoid receptor. I think people regret that they ever did that, because it wasn't until the 1990s that the same lab actually discovered why we have those receptors. And they discovered that we make this drug in our brain, our own drug, and they called it anandamide. That's a Sanskrit word for supreme joy. So it's part of our system that helps us balance and feel, you know, basically good, stable, normal. And so we have these anandamides that work in these receptors. And the anandamides are created locally. They're created immediately for when they're needed, and then they're dissolved. So they're used locally, and then they're gotten rid of. THC is a fat-soluble substance that binds to the receptor and stays on it for a very, very long time. And that can really affect development, because during adolescence, the brain is making a decision using these receptors of what are we keeping and what are we getting rid of. Because during adolescence, there's a lot of go, go, go neurons. Like we want to learn, we want to do, we want to record information. So there's a lot of the stimulatory neurons like dopamine and norepinephrine. And there's not too many of the brake neurons, which are serotonergic neurons, because those are mostly in your prefrontal motor cortex.
And those are the ones that make you stop doing stupid stuff?
Right, exactly. Okay. And so the anandamides are helping the brain decide during that period, are we going to keep this neuron? Are we going to myelinate this neuron to make it stronger and more active? Or are we going to prune this neuron? And if you put an exogenous source of THC into the brain at that time, you have absolutely no idea what you are doing to that process. And I think that's why there's so much research out there now showing lower IQs with people who start using marijuana during adolescence, and, you know, cognitive problems.
Right. Hence the word dude.
Exactly. And the clothing choices. That's always a big giveaway.
Yeah, that's great.
Sad. I mean, there's just so much of this that we see, and I don't know, I guess ultimately if you don't laugh a little
well,
bit,
I think we all knew that, you know, growing up,
this wasn't
you're
an
constantly
enhancement.
Well, you're constantly developing your brain, and when you drink alcohol or do any kind of a drug, you're going to do something to the brain, good or bad. It's obviously going to have an impact on that development. So it's interesting.
And now we've legalized something that actually makes it function less well, which, you know, I mean, for anybody who's driven a car lately on a public roadway, I'm thinking functioning better would be.
Yeah. Would be nice, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Be super. So we'll take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, easy for me to say, Dr. Libby Stout. We are chatting about THC and marijuana and how it affects your brain. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us.
So she tucks her kids in at night, kisses her husband, turns off the light, talks to God. Says the Lord, help me accept what I can't change. But until I learn to do that, thanks for the Mary Jane. 'Cause you know life will let you down, love's gonna leave you lonely. Sometimes the only way to get by is to get high. Kids are different today, I hear every mother say,
mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day.
The modern version of Mother's Little Helper.
I took it out of the middle of the song, but I thought, well, that's my Fair and Balanced, by the way. That's the Fair and Balanced portion of the show. So back in the, we had the two moms, right? So we got the mom now who's, you know, smoking pot, and the mom then, she's probably smoking pot too, but anyway. She was eating Valiums or something?
Yeah,
was
Valium.
I don't know what was yellow.
Little yellow pill.
It was no mom then.
So one of the things that I hear people say is when they smoke, they're more focused and more attentive. It helps them study. What do you say?
After reading
that?
Your article, it's like, this couldn't possibly be true.
Yeah, what's the illusion there?
Well, I think that's an interesting observation. Many people do say that, but it seems to be somewhat delusional because most of the studies that have been done looking at cognition show that it makes cognition worse in the long run. Now, it's kind of like nicotine. Most people, when they use nicotine for the very first time, they can focus better because it does help with focus and concentration. But then the problem is they become addicted to it, and nobody actually uses, well, some people do. There are the occasional smokers, occasional people, but most people, when they get started using tobacco, they become addicted to it. And then it makes them worse because then they're in withdrawal, and withdrawal is you can't focus, can't concentrate. And so we see the same thing with marijuana, that if somebody was just using it occasionally, small doses, it might be beneficial in that regard. But most people are not doing it that way. And that becomes the problem, because part of the marijuana withdrawal is also irritability, anxiety, can't focus. And so then you have to smoke again. And then you're in this vicious cycle.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really help anybody. But they've done studies looking at college students, and there was actually an interesting one in somewhere around. I don't think colleges were Yale, but it was done around the Yale area, and they looked at students through a semester of, you know, whether they were using alcohol, marijuana, or alcohol and marijuana, or marijuana alone, and they didn't have enough people just using marijuana alone to study that, but they found that the people that had the lowest GPA at the end of the semester were the people using alcohol and marijuana. And you know, those are people that probably have pretty good brain cells. You know, many of the studies on IQ says there's like an average loss of 8 points in your IQ. And if somebody is Mensa, or, you know, they have a really high IQ, that may not be a big deal. People may say, oh, I'm doing just fine. But if you're at the average IQ, which is 100, so that's 50% of the population are average, and you drop your IQ by 8 points, you're down to 29th percentile.
Yeah, you're on the short bus.
So that really can affect people's ability to function in life. And they're less likely to go to college, get married, do things.
And, well, hold a productive job, and now that
exactly
you need to have some skills, and you know, I mean, people who hire other people would like them to have some skills, be able to pay attention and do things. And somebody with a 92 IQ isn't probably going to be your stellar performer,
right?
And the world's gotten very technical.
And the concern is, for me, the biggest concern is you can't prevent the youth from using. And
sure,
especially if their parents are using, and their parents have the attitude that there's nothing wrong with it. And we have, in this society right now, the there's a big perception that marijuana is safe, it's green, it's organic, it doesn't have any problems, and it's good to use because it has all these medical things and it cures all these things, which none of that is true, but that's the message that everybody's getting. And so we're seeing more and more adolescents using.
And yeah, I saw in your article here that 65% increase in Colorado since in high school age kids since they legalized it, because that I guess that just sent the message is, hey, it's okay, it's legal, it's there's nothing wrong with it.
Right, but then there is also this really new study that just came out this past year, 2018, out of Denver, where they're looking at adolescent emergency room and urgent care visits. And they just looked at the marijuana-related diagnostic codes and the positive urine drug screens, and then looked at the difference between 2005, when, you know, we had medical, we didn't have recreational, up to 2015, which is a year into recreational. And they found that the visits of these adolescents jumped from 161 in 2005 to 777 in 2015.
Wow.
Wow. And what's very scary is that 67% of them required a behavioral health evaluation. So
wow.
They weren't there just for medical problems. They were there for mental health problems.
Yeah.
And 71% ended up with a diagnosis related to marijuana and mental illness.
Yeah. So.
And so this is one of the things that we're seeing. Because a lot of people have this perception, well, I smoke marijuana because it helps with my anxiety or it helps with my depression. And most of the studies are showing the opposite, that it actually makes person depressed and makes people anxious. And so in this study out of Colorado, that was what the number one diagnoses they were seeing were depression, mood disorders, and anxiety disorders.
When they first start use, is it different than let's say a year into using, you know, maybe when they first start using it, they do get some medical benefits, but then that quickly
goes
away.
Down the drain.
Yeah, is that the case at all?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question, because it's kind of like the chicken or the egg. There was a big study in Australia, this is back in 2002, where they tracked 1,600 girls for 7 years, and that's a huge study.
Yeah.
And they were following them, they picked them up before they had any issues with depression or anxiety, and they followed them for 7 years, and then they looked at the people that used marijuana versus the people that didn't. And they found that the people who used marijuana every day were 5 times more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety than the non-users. And if they used it at least once a week, they were twice as likely to develop depression.
That's still a lot.
And then, And then, of course, they, you know, the same study looked at the incidence of psychotic symptoms, so the risk of developing a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and they found a significant increase in that if they started using before the age of 15. And so, to me, that supports the idea that, no, they didn't have the problems, and marijuana made the problems.
Mm.
But nobody knows exactly. It's just that we know eventually, after some use, people are having worse problems with these things. And,
yeah.
You know, we've seen a significant increase in the rate of serious mental illness among young adults, and that's the people that are 18 to 25. And if you look at any of the data right now, nationwide, the people using the most marijuana are the ones 18 to 25.
Yeah,
so,
that's
again,
bad.
Kind of an easy correlation to, you know, make.
Yeah. Well, everybody wants to say, well, correlation doesn't mean causation. But when you keep seeing the same correlation over and over and over again, you start thinking maybe there is definitely causation.
Well, and you point out an excellent thing in your article, just right there on the second page, that because there was initially no regulation on the edibles, so that's the candy and all that stuff, They have been made to look very similar to regular products that people consume, such as chocolates, gummy bears, Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts, what the heck? And so then you have all this accidental exposure and overdose of kids. I mean, they even named one kind Girl Scout cookies. I was reading in your thing.
Yeah, who's that?
It's like, who are we marketing that to?
Well, right, and there was recently a big deal, and there was a big published thing of picture of Girl Scouts selling Girl Scout cookies in front of a dispensary. And, I mean, a lot of people I know challenged the Girl Scout Council about that. Like, you think this is a good thing? Because it does send this message to the girls, I think, that, you know, this is okay.
Yeah.
And...
Well, your point, you can't, you really can't take it too seriously, the idea. I mean, you really have to think about it. We have demonized cigarettes. We've had all these DARE programs in school. I was never able to remember what the stupid drug, the DARE thing. We laughed about it years ago when we first moved to an area that had that, and we laughed and called it Drugs Are Really Exciting. It's not the right name, and I've never been able to relearn that. But it's about drugs are really bad, but that doesn't spell DARE. So kids are really paranoid in a lot of cases. You know, ooh, cigarettes, oh, they're really bad, you know. And
yes.
Now
yes.
Here we're making, you know, suckers and Pop-Tarts and all these things. And if their parents have those laying around, especially little kids, little kids put everything in their mouth.
Looks yes, like, absolutely.
Looks like candy. You put it in there twice.
Yeah, we've seen significant increases in children coming to the emergency room because exactly that.
Well, and those are the things that are like 90% THC.
Yeah, scary. Very scary.
When we come back, I want to know what the long-term kids who get involved in that stuff, peripherally, parents aren't paying attention. They've got all these edibles hanging around and they don't notice their kid has been staring at the same spot on the ceiling for... you know, half a day. What happens when little kids get exposed to that for long term? We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Libby Stout. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Whether we like it or not, the best I can tell, the world's gone to hell and we're all gonna miss it a lot. All the whiskey in Lynchburg, Tennessee just couldn't hit the spot. Got $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend, it's all going to pot. I got $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend, cause it's all going to pot.
Because I got high.
Go to the next.
I was gonna go to work, but then I got high. I just got a new promotion, but I got high. Now I'm selling dope, and I know why, because I got high, because I got high, because I got high. La da 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 da. I was gonna go to court before I got high. Ooh, I was gonna pay my child support.
And the song starts out lower than that, and it goes downhill from there. But that's the way it goes. And I guess part of playing these songs, not only are they kind of funny, but they're kind of funny. And a lot of them, you know, we've heard for a lot of years. I mean, Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson, I mean, I heard these people have been around for a long time. So we've normalized it there as well. And of course, we're
right.
Contributing to the problem. But what happens with kids when they're exposed to this stuff as little kids?
Well,
turn out like the guy in the song.
the problem is it actually primes the brain. One of the things that we know about the development of addiction is exposure during childhood adolescence can increase the risk of addiction. It doesn't make the person become an addict, but it can prime the brain so that when the person actually decides to use for the first time, they can be hooked the minute they use. And a lot of this research has been done with tobacco, but it really applies to any smoked drug, because when you're sitting in a room full of smoke or a car or something where somebody else is smoking, the secondhand smoke gets into your brain. I mean, it clearly does.
Right.
This is actually how we got smoking out of airlines, because they found that when people were non-smokers in the front of the plane, after they got off the plane and they had to pee in a cup, they had enough nicotine in their urine as if they smoked three cigarettes. So it gets into your body, which also gets into your brain. And so kids that have this exposure early on, their brain becomes primed to that. And I see so many people in the treatment program that I run, who especially about tobacco, they go, I can't stand the fact that I smoke. I was never going to smoke. I hated the fact that my parents smoked. I said, well, what happened? And said, I don't know. When I was 13, I took a cigarette, and I was addicted that minute. And I think that's part of the process, is that you get exposed to it, but then it's, you know, usually peer pressure during adolescence that causes kids to use things. And if they've been exposed to it already, then they're likely to be addicted from the minute they use it.
The first contact with it, they are hooked.
Because they already had that wiring all done.
Right, exactly.
And I don't think people really understand that.
Yeah.
I really don't. Is this... I'm not going to say this is publicly available, because obviously you're not a secret psychiatrist. all confidentiality aside... But, I mean, do people, I don't know, I guess I've never really heard that. I've never studied it. But that's not really being widely shared, I don't think.
No, and I would agree with that. And that's why I try and do a lot of education. I mean, I can point people to all kinds of research done with animals. I mean, there's many studies done with rats and mice where they expose them as adolescents to nicotine, for example, and then they're more likely to use nicotine as adults than if, you know, they press the lever for it. But there's also cross-tolerance in the brain. So the brain doesn't really see these as different. The brain just says, oh, these are all drugs of abuse, because they all work in the exact same place in the brain. And so there are studies showing that you expose an adolescent rat to nicotine, they're more likely to press the lever for cocaine. Or you expose them to Ritalin as an adolescent, and they're more likely to press the lever for cocaine. There's even a psychiatrist who has tried to use the same theory to explain why anesthesiologists are the branch of medicine that have the most addiction problems. And it's not because people go into that with the plan of becoming addicted. But what he's discovered is that the problem can be is that fentanyl, which is the primary drug used to put people to sleep in the operating room, is injected into the body, and then it goes through the body, and then the person breathes it out. So the person sitting closest to the head the entire time they're in the room is the one most exposed. Now, that doesn't make them an addict, but I can absolutely see this happening, where the person says, you know, I wonder what the big deal with this drug is. So they have a little spill of fentanyl, and they put a little drop on their finger and put it under their mask on their gum. And they could be addicted from that minute just because they've been exposed to it. And now they are getting used to it. And then they start using it. And this is a serious problem in different areas of... Because I know actually from my own experience, I have several classmates that were found dead in call rooms because of using fentanyl.
Wow.
And so I think that the exposure data is very powerful, and I think people need to think about that. And this is why whenever I'm teaching anybody, like my patients, I get them to swear that they will stop smoking around children. Don't smoke in a car, don't smoke in a house, you know, don't smoke anything. You know, marijuana, nicotine, crack, heroin, because the smoke gets it into other people's bodies.
Right.
Wow, that's really something you don't think about. It seems like,
right,
you know, the effect would basically be over. So, and I know in the video that we have attached on the page from the talk you did earlier in the month, you were speaking about your practice helping people get off drugs, and you had said something that I think everyone in the room knows, that when people go to AA, they smoke tons of cigarettes. I mean, if you've ever been, you know, your church basement or, you know, some room in a building that you also use is also the AA room. It's like 9,000 ashtrays in there. It's pretty common.
Right.
And a lot of people in AA smoke. I mean, again, I kind of wish we had that button. We could say, okay, how many of you out there, you know? But you had said that if they don't give up everything, the wiring never gets changed.
Well, this is because of the effect of these drugs, and this is all addictive drugs,
right,
on the hippocampus. So the hippocampus is the part of our brain where we put all of our new memory and learning. So it's where you put the important stuff you want to remember. And the hippocampus is a part of your brain that actually regenerates. So there are new cells being born all the time in that part of your brain as stem cells that grow and differentiate. But the problem with all addictive drugs, and this includes THC, nicotine, just chronically can actually suppress neurogenesis and actually shrink the hippocampus. So they have imaging data showing that hippocampuses are smaller. And that makes it difficult to learn new things. And so this is why if somebody is in treatment for drug abuse and they're smoking the whole time they're in treatment, they're having difficulty learning anything new.
Right.
And this
right.
is why I advocate that all treatment programs, if it's residential or inpatient, should be totally tobacco-free, because you can control that. You know, they control everything else. You can't use any other drugs when you're there. And so they should be tobacco-free. Outpatient, difficult to control. But now, one of the things that they've discovered from imaging is that it takes 90 days for a stem cell to grow and differentiate in your hippocampus. Now, that makes complete sense, because if you think about AA, if you've ever been there before, they have a common saying that says 90 and 90. That means if you want to quit drinking, you have to not drink today and go to a meeting to ensure you don't drink today. And if you do that 90 days, you're going to start getting it. Well, and my point when I mentioned this was, I said, but this is why most people don't recover in AA right away, because AA is a cup of coffee in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand.
And a lot of cookies.
So you're basically still suppressing
neurogenesis. I've really been there, but.
Right.
And so if you really want to get better, like learn something new, because I truly believe recovery is completely possible. And I see many people recover really completely.
And see, that's a really important message for people to hear. I hate to do this to you, but we have a 5-minute news break that is creeping on us.
Yeah, I want to get back to this.
So we have a whole nother hour with Dr. Libby Stout. You are listening to We the People. You can find all the information we're discussing at wethepeopleradio.us.
I want to feel its way. I want to feel its way. Put some feel good in my soul. Drink a little drink, smoke a little smoke. Want a little more right and a little less left.
Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cunniff, and our sponsor this hour is Teen Power.
You cut me right out of that.
Yeah, I did. Totally. I'm just going to move right along, and hopefully I don't get interrupted. our sponsor is Teen Power. They're our local Kubota tractor dealer. They're up on Twin View Boulevard, 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and they do everything tractors there. It doesn't matter what the brand, bring it in, they can work on it. Parts, sales, they do it all up there. Their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call, or you can get them on the web at readingtractors.com. Right now they're running a service special. You can give them a call, get it scheduled, and you'll get a discounted rate on labor to do your spring service.
And we all know how that happens. It's winter, it's winter, it's winter. Bam, it's spring.
And it doesn't start, so then you're panicked, and yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, get it done now and get it done cheaper. So Team Power.
Bingo.
Bingo. There you go.
Wow. So we are chatting with Dr. Libby Stout. This is the second hour of a two-hour program with her. We called the show This Is Your Brain on Marijuana, just because I remember when we were kids, they had that commercial with the frying pan. And it's weird. I had a fried egg on my way before we came here.
Oh,
it must have been subliminal advertising.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they'd crack that egg into a really hot skillet, and they'd say, you know, this is your brain on drugs. And I mean, I'm 57 or 8. I don't remember what I am. Anyway, I'm something like 57 or 58 years old.
Your hippocampus is strong. You can't even remember how old you are.
What the hell? I'm just 92 average. I'm just 8 below. Anyway, I remember that because we did demonize drugs back then. And now we've got, you know, people want stores. Towns want to have stores, and they think there's going to bring all this revenue. And there's a tremendous cost to society for making this readily available, treating it like a natural product that has no, effects. And this doesn't come with directions. I mean, you can't get a dry cleaning bag that doesn't have a thing that tells you not to put it over your face. But you can go buy 90. I mean, you ever see that? You know, your dry cleaning bag and says, this is not a toy. And I'm thinking, wow, who did they have to?
Yeah, somebody did.
You know, what caused that?
Put it over their head and died. And it's like,
exactly.
I didn't know.
I thought it was a toy.
Yeah. I give it to my kids.
But they can ingest these drugs that are, for the people who missed the first hour, and you're thinking, oh, pot, it's no big deal. I smoked pot in high school. Okay. Well, it was probably 2% THC. And now a lot of this stuff, especially in the edibles, is up to 90-95%. And the stuff they're smoking is 28-29%. She was telling us
they're pushing for
40. So, Dr. Libby Stout, our guest, is a board-certified addiction psychiatrist and has worked in the addiction behavioral health field since 1990. So she deals with a lot of people who have addictions. And surprise, the product that's supernatural, oh, wait, it's addicting. So
yeah,
people have to actually go into programs.
At 2%, it wasn't so much, but at 28%,
then it was just a bad habit. You know, at 2%, everybody
stupid, and you know that you know live with
like
it.
Like the song we played last time, and then I got high, and then
now you're talking addiction, and a whole different set of problems come along with that.
So I would recommend you go back and listen to the first hour if you haven't. Send it to a friend. You can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us. And she has an excellent document on there. The problem with current high-potency THC marijuana from the perspective of an addiction psychiatrist. There's also a 27-minute video of a program she did in Mount Shasta here in Northern California, the first part of February here in 2019. And it's got all of her slides. The slides were super interesting, and Robert has done an excellent job of putting the slides in there so it's not just a blurry, fuzzy thing with a pointer shining on it. They're really good, and you can go learn some stuff. I also have like a sneak preview from a guy named Ben Court. I have his video from that same workshop is on there, and we'll have him on in the future. He kind of deals with this from the addiction standpoint and from a user standpoint. So that'll be interesting too. We're going to continue to pound away at the marijuana isn't good for you program. But we were hooked on our own drug here. We were hooked on the hippocampus.
Yeah, we were talking about the effect of marijuana on the hippocampus, and you were saying that regular use actually shrinks that part of the brain. My question is, if you get off of it, does it ever like grow back, or have you done permanent damage?
And kind of tread, you know, kind of go backwards for people who don't know what a hippocampus is or does.
Okay.
It's in the brain. Right. There you go. That's the end of my knowledge.
So the hippocampus is part of your limbic system. So it's deep down inside of your brain. It's part of the primitive, prehistoric part of your brain. And it's where you put all your new memory and learning. It's a very important part of your brain in terms of learning anything new and remembering things, because pointers for everything you've learned get stored there, and then it triggers how to pull it out of your long-term memory storage bank. And so, as I said before, there's new cells being born and differentiated all the time in your hippocampus, except when you're using addictive substances chronically, and this is all addictive substances, so alcohol, marijuana, THC, nicotine, opiates. So if you're using them chronically, you can actually shrink the hippocampus.
Can you get just a teeny bit closer to your phone, Libby? You're faded out a little bit.
So you actually can shrink the hippocampus. And so imaging has shown this. Now, we don't know exactly yet because all this stuff with the high-potency THC is really new, and we're not don't have a whole lot of research on it yet. But there was a study I saw that was on chronic heavy marijuana users. So these are basically people that use every day. And they compared people with high THC marijuana to people with balanced CBD and THC to people that had been abstinent for like at least 29 months. And they found that, of course, the people with the high-potency THC had the smallest hippocampus. The people that were using with a balance of CBD had less shrinkage. They still had shrinkage, but they had less shrinkage, which kind of supports the idea that maybe CBD is somewhat protective to THC.
And how does the CBD, so for those people who pretty much never intend to do this but would like to warn someone else, How do those two interplay, and how would you take them? You know, what do they come in the form of?
This again is not that there's not that much known about this yet, but some of the stuff I've seen basically says that CBD may be allosterically knocks the THC off the receptor. The CBD doesn't bind to the receptor that's in the brain, but maybe knocks it off the receptor, because the THC binds pretty strongly, and as I said earlier, it's a long-acting chemical. It's not like our natural anandamides that are used and then destroyed immediately.
And it isn't like alcohol where, you know, you drink, you might have a hangover or something, and then it's over and done.
Right, yeah, alcohol is gone pretty quickly. THC is not. THC hangs around a long time. And so, but what the study showed was that the people that had been abstinent from marijuana for 29 months or more, actually their hippocampus grew back to normal size.
Oh.
The only problem with that study was they didn't do any functional testing. So we don't really know yet, is it totally back to normal? Like it works just as well as it ever did?
Maybe the lights are on and no one's home?
Yeah, well, at least we know it's growing back, so that you're having neurogenesis again, which
right.
is good. That's great.
Yeah.
And what some of the other things that I think are really fun facts, because this is what I do in my program, is one of the best things to increase neurogenesis in the hippocampus is voluntary exercise. So the more you can get somebody to exercise, the better for their brain.
Hmm. And the more pot they smoke, the less exercise they get, typically.
Right. And so that's why in my program you have to quit everything. And then we have rec therapy every single day, and you're supposed to go work out every single day.
Hmm. And does that make it, does the exercise part of it make it easier on the rehab? I mean, as far as withdrawal or... you know, the symptom of withdrawal, does the exercise improve that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think exercise improves everything.
Huh.
And of course, it has to be voluntary. You can't force somebody to do it, or then that's stress. Because another thing that shrinks the hippocampus is stress.
Uh-huh.
So if people are traumatized or involved in a traumatic relationship or a very stressful situation, they also have difficulty learning anything new because their hippocampus is shrunk.
Oh,
well, this is probably why pot isn't that good for people with PTSD, which we'll be getting to here in a little bit.
You're stressing me out, dude. Yeah.
You're going the other room, dude.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to take a quick break because now we've lapsed into silliness.
Okay.
Take a quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Libby Stout. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You know I'm here for the party, and I ain't leaving till they throw me down. But I had a little.
side. He looked in the mirror and his eyes were clear for the first time in a while.
That is what happens. All those years went by wasted. Bad deal. So, I guess I should let people in on our little conversation there at 1 o'clock. She's like, I didn't know there were this many songs about pot. I'm like, oh. It was like I had a list like 30 long. I'm like, oh, man, I don't have that many breaks. There's a plethora, and actually songs about alcohol, I mean, as you would normally figure. There are just zillions of them, and lots of things you didn't listen to them like that before. But when you do a search, all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, I guess it could mean that.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
Yeah.
This list you have on the article was really, I thought, interesting, that with the increased potency of THC, that the recognized withdrawal syndrome, which includes increased anger, irritability, depression, restlessness, headache, loss of appetite, insomnia, and severe cravings for marijuana. It's like, well, those all sound great, but how many people do you have that come into your practice? Because I know you told a story in the workshop, and you had said that people come in and they're like, oh, I can't sleep. You're like, well, quit smoking pot. And they're like, oh, I just can't sleep. Pot makes me feel better. And then they come back in, you know, I quit smoking pot, and gosh, I can sleep again. Does that just happen all day long?
Yes, I. I see so many people, and this isn't in my addiction treatment program. This is in my work in the community, just as a psychiatrist for people that have, you know, medical problems, and they're referred to see the psychiatrist because they have psychiatric issues. And I invariably see the same thing over and over again. People, they're complaining all of these symptoms. They can't sleep. They're anxious. They're depressed. And I get the history that they're vaping like 60 to 70% THC oil, or they're eating edibles, or they're smoking dab. And
yeah,
I tell them, you know, I think all of your problems are your marijuana use. And they tell me, no, that's my medicine. And I said, well, then why are you seeing me? Well, you need to give me my medicine.
Yeah, not that medicine.
And so, because your one example was somebody who had come to you for like a year and then finally quit smoking pot and their life totally turned around. It was like an epiphany. You're like, I had that epiphany a year ago.
Yeah, well, it's a really hard sell because people do think that it's helping them. But the only way I can get people to see that it's not is for them to quit. But it's a really hard thing to do, to get people to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long do they have to be off it before they start to notice a difference? I realize everybody's, you know, wired different, but ballpark.
Yeah, it's going to be different, but it's still long time relative to other things. I mean, most people, like if I treat somebody who's addicted to alcohol, normally within a month they're back to feeling pretty normal. Like there's kind of resolution of their symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But for marijuana, it takes a whole lot longer.
What one of the things you talked about in your article is the use of marijuana in the treatment of PTSD, and yet there's been no verifiable studies that show that it actually helps. Talk to us a little bit about that and what the actual result is when using that for PTSD.
Yeah, well, very good point, because All the stuff that's out there is anecdotal. So there's all kinds of people that say, oh, it really helps me. But there has been no real study. And I know there's some in the works, but I haven't seen the results yet. I'm waiting to see what the results are. But no legitimate study, and it's all anecdotal. And my point with this is, it's anecdotal just like alcohol. You know, most people find that alcohol helps their PTSD. It doesn't help it in the long run because they get addicted to it and then they have all kinds of problems because of alcohol. But, and the VA learned the hard way with benzos. So they were using benzos for all these people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to help with their post-traumatic stress disorder with horrible results. But it initially works because it numbs you, and that's exactly what the marijuana does. It numbs you. So yes, while you're experiencing the symptoms, you can smoke marijuana and the symptoms are gone, basically, because you're numb, you don't care.
Right.
However, then it wears off and the symptoms are right back. So you have to keep smoking in order to keep the symptoms at bay.
And I think so, that's where people say it's good for PTSD, is because it does. I mean, it's a bad deal. And if they can smoke it and feel better,
it feels like it's going the right direction.
It feels like you're helping, but the minute you stop smoking it, it's not making it go away. It's not really addressing. It's just it's treating it. It's not really
well. And you run the risk because you know, you increase depression. I thought it was interesting. I know there are not a lot of like young girls that have PTSD, so we're sort of blurring the line here. But there was one part in your article that said they found that girls who use marijuana at least once a week were twice as likely to develop depression than those who didn't use. Those who use marijuana every day were five times more likely to suffer from depression. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a teenager at home who's depressed, you know, before you put them on some medicine, real medication, you might want to check and see if they're using pot.
Mm-hmm. But I guess
absolutely true. Because the thing with the post-traumatic stress disorder, yes, it does work. But I want people to know that PTSD is curable. You can completely recover from PTSD if you get the appropriate treatment. Marijuana is not treating it. It is just numbing it. It's masking the symptoms so that the PTSD is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And so and it continues. And one of my real big concerns is the huge correlation we're seeing with suicide and the use of marijuana. And again, is that causation? Who knows? But the correlation is huge. And there's a very big study out of the VA looking at cannabis use disorder and the increase in suicide. And
and what's cannabis
phenomenal.
Use disorder? Like what?
Well, that's the addiction. That's, you know, we're now in DSM-5. We don't use dependence or addiction anymore. We call them use disorders.
Brother.
So cannabis use disorder is basically somebody who is addicted to cannabis. And so this study out of the VA was over 3,000 veterans, and they were following them for whether they were using cannabis or not, if they had a lifetime history of suicide attempts or not. And they found a significant increase in suicidal ideation with the people that were using cannabis, an increase in lifetime suicide attempts. It was a dramatic difference. And so the other thing that I have really difficulty with, and I see this a lot with people that we work with, because I will get somebody who cannabis is their drug of choice, and almost everybody that goes through my program has significant post-traumatic stress disorder kind of stuff. A lot of it is multi-complex trauma that happened from childhood on up. And so they have a lot of trauma issues. And what I've found is sometimes we think we're working on an issue that really happened, and it turns out it's a delusion, that there never, this incident that we're trying to help them resolve actually never happened the way they think it did, because it's become part of their delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was just seeing that as a weird thing. But then there's a study out there that totally supports what I'm seeing, and it's about false memories. And the paper is entitled
"Sounds Like the Kavanaugh Hearing."
False. Cannabis users show increased susceptibility to false memories. And the way they studied this was they actually had, they compared 16 heavy cannabis users to 16 matched cannabis naive controls. And then they had the cannabis users abstain from cannabis use for 4 weeks. And then they did this memory paradigm test where they put them in an MRI scanner and they gave them 20 lists of 4 words. So they had to remember, they had to memorize the words. And while they're in the MRI, they asked them if, like, was this word on the list? And what they found was the people that used marijuana were much more likely to falsely recognize a word. Like they'll say, was this word on the list? And they say yes. And they'll say, well, no, sorry, that was not on the list. But the most dramatic part of that was they were much more likely to refuse to accept that. So they would not reject that. So it was like, was this word on the list? Yes, it was. Well, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't. Yes, it was.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And
you were late yesterday. No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
So then I wonder, you know, how do you treat people's trauma if the trauma is actually a delusion that was created by the psychotic part of induced by marijuana? That's scary.
Hey, that's when you have to go get a comfort pig. Oh, sorry, that was just something I dealt with last week. Oh, we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Libby Stout. We are chatting about how marijuana affects your brain. Stick with us.
I only got time for a couple of beers and a jukebox song ringing in my ear. The next thing you know, the bartender's pouring, shots are flowing, got me stoned. All I really know is that I should be going, but I'm soaking up the moment. I'm all jacked up.
In a stem, you can bake it in some brownies, smoke it through a ball, roll up a great big fat one like old Cheech and Chong, burn it through a hole in a can of Budweiser. If you can't take the heat, son, vaporizer. That old wacky tobacco, when you feel it creeping up on.
Even Toby Keith is in it.
That's right. A little wacky to backy.
Oh, that kind of a catchy tune, though, so I had to use that one. So on the PTSD thing, in case, you know, we just don't want to let that go too quickly because that's a really big thing, and I think people are being really grossly misinformed because I hear veterans tell me all the time that their doctor at the VA told them they should start smoking marijuana. But there's a line in your... in that PDF we have online, I guess I haven't given the website in a while, it's at wethepeopleradio.us, and you can just read it online or download it. But this document that's on here that you had written, those who were using marijuana but stopped using it in treatment had the lowest level of PTSD symptoms 4 months after treatment. But those who started smoking marijuana had the highest levels of violent behavior and PTSD symptoms 4 months after treatment. I mean, that was one of those where I was like, did I just read what I think I read and I go back, do it again?
Right. That's right. There's not any
good
studies out there showing the benefit of marijuana for PTSD, but there is this big observational study that they did out of the VA where they observed over 2,000 veterans that were treated in VA PTSD treatment programs around the country. And they just compared them based on their use of marijuana. And so the PTSD treatment program is like an inpatient one-month program, and then they followed them for 4 months after that. And they found that the people that never used marijuana had significantly lower symptom severity, meaning the PTSD treatment helped them. The people who stopped using marijuana actually had the lowest level of PTSD symptoms after 4 months of treatment, so they did the best. And the people who started smoking marijuana had the highest levels of violent behavior and PTSD symptoms 4 months after treatment. So even though they had been through treatment, they didn't benefit from it, and the marijuana was making them worse. And this is, you know, just an observational study. So this is actually what happened with these people.
So what is treatment? I mean, what's the alternative to marijuana on this PTSD thing? When you say they underwent treatment, what? I don't know, maybe that's...
Well, there's several evidence-based treatments that work quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, well, like a lot of people use cognitive behavioral treatment. There's prolonged exposure therapy, which is used a lot in the VA. And the thing that we use in my program that I think is the best is EMDR, or eye movement desensitization reprocessing kind of treatment, which is using... You know, tracking eye movements across the corpus callosum. I can explain how this works scientifically, but this is kind of outside the scope of this.
Right.
But we've already admitted that we don't have the vaguest idea what you're talking about.
But these are treatments that actually can cure the problem.
Sure. Right.
And they actually, people can recover completely from post-traumatic stress disorder. But it takes work, and there's no magic pill, and there's no magic thing you can smoke that makes it all go away. You have to process it. So it's a way of processing the memories and changing them. It doesn't make the memories go away, but it makes the memories more,
acceptable.
Like you can
just less debilitating.
Right.
Well, all of these things that are, I mean, this is a, you know, fairly long document that... You have gone on to say, I mean, once you kind of move through the PTSD part, it said multiple studies have documented a relationship between cannabis use and suicidality. A large study in Australia and New Zealand of over 2,000 adolescents found almost a sevenfold increase in suicide attempts in daily marijuana use users. I mean, that's
significant.
Because our teen suicide, I think it was Ben Cort in his, did he talk about it or did you? Somebody was talking about the teen suicide at that presentation earlier in the month. And I was blown away by the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, they're significant. And if you look at the data out of Colorado, the number one drug in teen suicides is marijuana.
That's... Yeah. See, I don't
and
think
see, they'll
people
say,
realize
they'll say
that.
All the time, marijuana never killed anybody. Alcohol kills people all the time. It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Now, in the Colorado, this is from the Public Health and Environment Department of Colorado. The marijuana is the number one drug in toxicology in suicides from adolescents 10 to 19, and alcohol is the next highest, but it's not as high as marijuana.
Wow.
Which, again, it goes back to causality. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean...
With every kid, but still.
But
if
still,
you're a parent,
present, yeah.
If you know parents out there who are falling under this spell of, well, you might as well let your kid smoke pot, it's better than alcohol, and, you know, that kind of... And everybody does it, and it's no big thing, and I used to do it back in the 60s or 70s. I don't think they realize the risk profile has... I mean, now there is a risk.
Changed dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, there really wasn't one a long time ago. Your article also says here, misguided marijuana advocates have recently been suggesting marijuana is a solution for the opioid epidemic. I wanted to make sure we didn't skip over this part. Yeah, which is
basically bizarre.
You didn't say this, I did, but it's pure fiction.
Yes, and it is pure fiction. You just have to look to Colorado, because, I mean, there's several things that have made me very concerned. The fact that we actually publish things before people actually get real data. Like, there was what I think was really irresponsible reporting in the American Journal of Public Health, which is a reputable journal, but these people back in 2017 reported about... they said that recreational cannabis legalization opiate-related deaths. So they published this curve, which showed continually increased opiate-related deaths. And then in 2014, when we legalized recreational marijuana, and then they show this slight line going back down, where they say, "Oh, look, it stopped the deaths from re." But you know, you don't report something with just 1 year data. I think they needed to wait for 3 more years. And then the other thing was, 2014 was when in Colorado we mandated the use of the PDNP, where doctors had to look it up to see who all is getting prescribed opiates by other people. And, and the reality is...
that would lower the deaths, wouldn't it?
The opiate-related deaths just continue to rise. And so, yes, in 2014, there was kind of a like a leveling off to 2015. And then it just has continued to rise. So in 2017, we had the greatest number of opiate-related deaths we have ever had in Colorado. And we've had marijuana available since 2000. So it isn't making it better. And one of the things I think is kind of funny, there was a study, and they weren't really trying to, I think, find a treatment for this, but this was marijuana users who were not treatment seeking, and they just wanted to see if naltrexone, which is an opiate blocker, affected their marijuana use. And so they were in a laboratory setting where they were allowed to smoke as much marijuana as they wanted to, and they were monitored, and all they had to do was take a pill, either a placebo or the naltrexone, the opiate blocker. And they found that those that got the naltrexone used significantly less marijuana than the people who weren't. So basically, that kind of shows that the opiate receptors and the marijuana receptors work kind of together in the brain. And then there was a study on these were on products of abortion. So these were fetuses that were from women who had abortions. And they looked at the difference in the brain circuitry of the fetuses that were exposed to marijuana during the pregnancy to those that had no exposure to marijuana. And they found that the opiate-related genes were significantly different in those ones exposed to marijuana. And we don't know what happened to those babies, but it's very similar to rat data that shows if you give a pregnant rat marijuana, their offspring are much more likely to push the lever for heroin than if they were not exposed to marijuana.
So marijuana is not an opioid, but it affects the opioid receptors in the brain the same way. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Like when they're smelling, you know, the pot smoke and all that, and then all of a sudden they try something and they're magic, you know, they're addicted.
Right.
And the one that's most compelling to say that this is, you know, absolutely not the solution, it's going to make it worse, is this really huge study that was using NESCAR data. So this is national data where they're getting data from over 34,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at people in wave one, which were 2001 to 2002, and looked at their cannabis use in that period. And then in wave two, looked at their opiate use, which was 2004 to 2005. And what they found was that people had no cannabis use, basically had no opiate use. The occasional users of marijuana had more opiate use, and the frequent users and very frequent users had significantly more prescriptions of opiates that they received. So to think that giving people marijuana is going to decrease their opiate use is crazy. It's just not going to happen. And I think it's not good for public officials, and I know even famous physicians, you know, have come online in news shows saying, yes, they support this. There's no data out there that supports it, and the data that is out there says bad idea.
That it's all wrong.
So well, do you think maybe they're thinking that way to
hold on, we have to take a
replace
quick break.
The opioid with marijuana?
Bill doesn't smoke pot, so he'll be able to remember his question until after the break.
Okay.
This is a test. This is the hippocampus break for Bill. You're listening to We the People. We'll be right back. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
No whiskey when I've had a bad day. No prescription, honey, when my skies are gray. No popping the pills, no smoking the pills to make me feel okay. You go down easy, baby. I could drink you by the case. You're my painkiller.
Downside. He's throwing up. So much for that fun romanticized version. It's over now.
Yeah. So my question here, just so I'm clear on this replacement of marijuana with the opioids, are they saying
reverse that?
Yeah, replace the opioids with marijuana.
The hippocampus test.
Are they saying that is a treatment to get off opioids because it's better to smoke marijuana than take opioids? Is that?
Yeah, what is the logic there?
What is the logic?
Well, that has been the logic. Oh. I mean, there's been no studies showing that. I do think that when pushed, people will say that, well, what they're really recommending is CBD. I haven't seen the data. I haven't seen anybody do real research on that to show that CBD decreases the use of opiates. But, you know, they're saying that CBD can be helpful for pain, so...
Yeah, what about that? Are there studies on that? Because I have a associate, let's say, that wanted to look into CBD.
Is this one of those friend stories?
Yes, a friend. They had... they work with their hands, and they have a lot of arthritis pain. And somebody recommended the CBD oil for that. Is that a legitimate treatment?
Well, that's what we don't know. I mean, I would love to see the real legitimate double-blind placebo-controlled trials that show in large numbers that it really is effective. But they're just not out there.
Right.
And there are some things on CBD that are coming out that are showing benefit. But part of the problem is if you're talking to the people in the cannabis industry, they want the whole plant. They think that the entourage effect is what's important. So
right.
You have to have the terpenes and the CBD and the THC and everything. And that's like almost impossible to study, really effectively.
Just too many moving parts.
Are trying to look at, you know, CBD. But also one of the problems is because there's not really good regulations, a lot of these products out of dispensaries are not well tested.
Right.
And since the plant has this phenomenal ability to suck up bad things in the soil, like heavy metals, I mean, that's a good thing for the plant. Like, hemp can actually clean up a soil area. However, it gets into the plant, and then if they're not testing the plant for heavy metals, people are then smoking it, and they're getting heavy metals in their system,
right?
which is not good for you. Or they're using the oil.
Now, the CBD oil, there's no high associated with CBD. It's only the THC that actually makes them feel good. Is that right?
Well, that's the common thought. Currently, yes.
Okay.
Until they figure out how to do something and jack up the CBD.
It's just really hard to know. And, you know, my big focus has been mostly on this really high potency THC stuff because that's where we're seeing all the really bad problems.
Right.
And I just don't know how we fix this because there should be regulations on it. There should be limits on the level of THC. And these concentrate products, I don't know what they're good for. I don't know any research out there that says smoking dab is good for anything medically.
And what is that even?
What is that? I've never heard of that.
I've heard of it, but I've seen the pictures of it you guys had, but what does it do? It looks like peanut butter.
Well, yeah, it's just a highly concentrated product of the THC.
And you light it on fire?
You know, they have to, yeah, and they have to extract the THC, and they do that through oil usually, butane or propane. Or
supernatural there, you know,
dioxide.
Butane.
Mm-hmm.
What I want
to they
put in my
they
body.
Have to extract it, and then they concentrate it way down, and it can be a gummy substance, or it can get, like, peanut brittle. And then they smoke those things. And usually people are smoking them with a blowtorch.
What?
Mm, yeah. That should be
with
good
a
for
blowtorch? Wow. yes. And so now that everybody has a real clear picture in their mind, here the near the end of the article it says, if states continue to commercialize marijuana, as has been done in Colorado, we're destined to see many more people requiring treatment for, I'm thinking, burns, but addiction, depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and psychosis, in addition to probably blowing up their house and lighting their furniture.
Yep.
I mean,
well, there's so many communities that are on kind of track to do what Colorado's done.
And they all think they're going to get all this tax money.
And there should be enough data out there to prove one way or the other whether that was a good move for Colorado. It sounds like maybe
well,
not.
Well, it does bring money, but it's mostly bringing money to the people that own the dispensaries and the people that are growing the plants.
Right.
I mean, the people thought it was going to bring all this tax money that was going to be usable, but in Colorado, it's less than 1% of the budget. So,
right.
I mean, it's...
But they also have to factor in the increased medical...
Yeah, the rehab and the emergency room and...
Exactly, the consequences. Exactly.
Well, the lack of productivity of your youth, I mean, potentially creating
right.
a wasted generation, no pun intended.
Well, and the fact that you can't hire people. I mean,
yeah.
There are a lot of safety-sensitive positions that have to interview thousands of people to get enough people to be considered for a job because they can't pass the drug test.
Well,
and we're seeing that here.
We're seeing that here.
Spades.
What was the number on the
Highway Patrol?
Highway Patrol was...
Highway Patrol had 650 positions at that time. It's not that long ago here in the last 6 months or a few months. And they said they'd go through probably 100,000... people to find those
600 positions. That's incredible.
It's enough to make you want to, you know, you just kind of have to stop and think about that. We don't even have 100,000 people in our town.
Yeah.
We interview everyone in our whole town. It's pretty bad.
I agree. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
And so, Libby, what are you finding out there? Are people really hungry for the information? Or are you having to kind of like, hello, you know? You having to sort of beat the door down or...
Well, I mean, once I start talking, people are like, I didn't know that, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. And why didn't we know this?
Right.
Before we legalized it and put it through our whole society.
Yeah. Because when I was in Canada, I went to another meeting up there for something else, but it was 10 days after they opened all the dispensaries. And so I just talked to everybody about it, so people sitting next to on the plane. And the people would... I just start telling them our experience, and the people would say, well, why didn't we know this? Why didn't we know this? And because they found that there's two types of people. There's the people that are very pro-pot, and they can't wait until it's legalized and available. And then there's the other group are the people that don't really know anything about it, and they just don't care.
And they don't care.
And they think that, well, it doesn't affect me, and maybe it'll, you know, if we legalize it, we'll get tax revenue, and it'll lower the crime, and that doesn't happen either.
Right. And so then when I start talking to that group of people, they're the ones going, well, why didn't we know this? Why didn't we get told this? And,
yeah,
that's the problem.
The industry does a really good job of making it all about how you hate cancer patients And you're just mean and you know, puritanical.
This is why I wish we had a ban on any advertising completely.
That would be useful too. Well, can you imagine we have hit the end of the road here. Told you this would go too fast.
I know it would.
I think we'll have to chat with you more in the not too distant future.
I think I heard in Colorado they're talking about maybe legalizing mushrooms now. So we'll be talking.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
Our guest has been Dr. Libby Stout. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
We're at the bar and we're having us some beers and swapping out on cares, talking politics, blonde and redhead chicks, old dogs and new tricks and habits we ain't kicked. We talked about God's grace and all the hell we raised. And then I heard the old man say, God is great, beer is good.